It's called the yuan, or the renminbi, the people's currency. Me? I just call it an economic indicator. That's what I call it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 11th of August. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And listen, the next time somebody tells you that this isn't a global economy, that we are all living and trying to get buy in, you just go and tell them to stick it in their ear. All right? You want to know why the stock market was down today? China. You want to know why companies like Apple and Caterpillar had a rough day? China. You want to know why oil was off? Yeah, I could go on. You get the picture. As of today, one American dollar can officially buy you 6.2298 Chinese yuan. That is the almost 2% currency devaluation that Beijing surprised us with overnight. We've got our Shanghai Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz on the phone to give us a little bit of context on this whole thing. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
Big surprise on this one, huh?
Yeah, you know, in fact, you know, the surprise came over the weekend when the government released a bunch of economic data. You know, it showed that exports from China were down 8% from last year. And that was a surprise for many economists. And by today, a lot of people were wondering when the central bank would let the currency depreciate by a meaningful amount to try and bring that number back up so that Chinese exports were suddenly a little cheaper. And that's exactly what they did.
Okay, so what's the deal here? Is this really the government doing something? Is it market forces? What's the behind the scenes?
Well, you know, you've just raised the essential question about how China's economy works. You know, when it comes to the day-to-day value of its currency, China's central bank sets rules for itself. Each day, it allows China's currency to appreciate or depreciate based on market fluctuations up to 2% in either direction. So today, the central bank claimed it let its currency depreciate to show the rest of the world that China was liberalizing its economy. But, you know, take note of my verb usage here. I said show. And that's how many independent economists see it. It's a show. The PBOC almost never allows the currency to fluctuate more than a fraction of a percent, and it very much controls the value of the yuan. So today, the central bank suddenly lets the yuan decline about as much as it can, 1.9%, saying all the while that it's doing this to let market forces take their natural course. One might argue that if they really wanted market forces to take their natural course, they'd get rid of this 2% rule and just let it go.
In the bigger picture here, it's been an interesting, I don't know what, 2 months for the Chinese government and its economy. I'm thinking now of their intervention in the stock market, trying to prevent that from falling farther. And now this. Read some tea leaves for me.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, China spent months boasting about how free the Shanghai Stock Exchange was, and then the whole thing crashes, and then the government rushes in to punish people who let it crash. You know, so much for a free market economy. But, you know, but to be fair, this is not easy for China. I think the government really wants to liberalize the economy. They really want to let market forces determine the fate of companies here. But they're entering uncharted territory. No economy of this size has embarked on a journey like this. It's really one of the biggest economic experiments the modern world has seen. And if they weren't failing at it at first, then I think a lot of economists would wonder whether they were really putting their money where their mouth was. My point here is that it's probably a good thing for China that it's been going through some rocky times. It shows the government might actually be serious about reforming the Chinese economy. You know, it might sound strange, but I think all of these failures are a sign of progress.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Kai.
Among the busiest people in capitalism today were surely the folks who work on the foreign exchange markets, the people who make and lose millions on even the slightest changes in currencies. So you can be sure they were working the phones today with that 1.9% devaluation of the yuan. But here's the reality of it. Currency, whether it's dollars or euros or yuan or what have you, currency is a commodity. And it responds to the underlying economic principles accordingly. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the how-to part of the devaluation story now.
Currency is like marmalade and Barbie dolls and lettuce and duct tape and coffee and anything that is ever bought and sold because it follows the law of supply and demand.
Whatever the supply and demand there is in the foreign exchange markets, that's what determines the exchange rate.
Winthin is global head of emerging markets at Brown Brothers Harriman. If nobody wants your currency, then its price in dollars goes down. If people love your currency, its price gets bid up. So when countries fool around with their exchange rates, they're finding a way to influence supply or demand. Ishwar Prasad teaches at Cornell.
If you increase the supply of your currency, that is going to reduce the price of that currency.
And that's what some countries do. The central bank literally goes out and sells a ton of its own currency. They make it a dime a dozen if they have to pull down the price. And sometimes a country wants to make its currency more expensive. So it'll take whatever dollars or euros it's saved up, go out onto the market, and buy back its own currency.
And bid up its price.
Robert Lawrence teaches international trade at Harvard.
And so that would cause your currency to appreciate.
It's like leaving your own Yelp review. And the U.S. and Europe usually don't like this sort of thing. They think of it as cheating. And China has definitely held down its currency in the past. But this time is different.
In the past, the market was trying to make the currency of China stronger, and they were resisting. Currently, the market is trying to move their currency weaker, and they're going along with it.
So it's not that China's cheating. It's more like it stopped cheating, because it doesn't have to. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Or it's leaving its own Yelp review. How great was that? As I believe I mentioned, traders did not at all care for what the Chinese currency devaluation was implying today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. At its most basic, the big Google slash Alphabet restructuring news is a way for a company that had arguably gotten too big to manage to make itself easier to handle, to separate what we've come to think of as the plain vanilla enterprises like Search and YouTube, Chrome and Android, from the dream big stuff like driverless cars, cures for aging and smart energy and all the rest of it. Or if you want to put it another way, it's a way to separate the money-making stuff from the crazy moonshots with their big R&D budgets and uncertain futures. So with that in mind, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now on what might happen next.
The new Alphabet might look like your run-of-the-mill conglomerate with lots of separate businesses that will sink or swim on their own. But that's not quite the plan here, says Danny Sullivan at Search Engine Land.
I think their founders see their mission of Alphabet not as we'll be a conglomerate that has a lot of businesses that make money, but we're going to be a conglomerate that has businesses that we think will change the world.
Inspiring words, but will the new structure actually help those visionary enterprises take off? Sullivan thinks it will. He also predicts Alphabet will be a magnet for tech types with seemingly crazy ideas that just might fly with some investment and time in the lab. Ditto for promising startups that don't want to get lost inside of boring old Google, says Scott Kessler at S&P Capital IQ.
If people want to work for an exciting, emerging business, they can do that under the auspice of Alphabet and not be mentally hamstrung by the notion of working for a company that I believe was founded in the 1990s.
Alphabet's new structure will also bring new scrutiny to all those visionary ventures, says Rick Summer at Morningstar.
Investors can now see how those businesses are performing over a longer period of time. So the company will be forced, I believe, to react and not continue to throw good money after bad.
That good money would be the steady profits from Google search and advertising. Analysts say that part of the business may also do better with its own CEO and tighter focus on the bottom line. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Politics, especially at the presidential level, can be expensive. That's one reason former Texas Governor Rick Perry has stopped paying his campaign staff, at least for the time being, one presumes. The thing is that Perry has raised millions of dollars, money that, the way campaign finance works, though, is locked up in super PACs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington explains what those groups can pay for.
Pretty much everything. there's essentially not much a super PAC couldn't do other than things that would require direct coordination with a candidate or their staff.
Sheila Krumholz of the Center for Responsive Politics says that means super PACs can run TV ads, print flyers, and even campaign door to door. Plenty of critics say that's too much outside influence, but lawyer Cleta Mitchell says not so. She's represented Republican super PACs and campaigns and says Perry's financial woes reveal a different problem.
The campaign finance laws that severely restrict the funding, it makes it very difficult to fund increasingly expensive campaigns, particularly national campaigns.
Stefan Passantino is the treasurer for the Opportunity and Freedom PAC, which has more than $10 million ready to back Perry.
The super PAC is allowed to do all of the traditional activities of a campaign other than pay for the staff and pay directly for the travel of the candidate.
He says with the new political reality, campaigns don't need big staffs, just enough to do what's legally required.
But that can be done on a fairly lean and mean basis.
And the Perry campaign is working out just how lean it can be. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The EPA now says that the Animas River in southern Colorado is going to be closed through at least next Monday. Administrator Gina Sullivan has taken full responsibility for the 3 million gallons of mine waste that spilled into the river 5 days ago. You've seen the pictures. You can probably imagine the toll they are taking on the businesses that rely on that river. Matt Wilson is the owner of Four Corner Whitewater Rafting. He is in Durango, Colorado. Mr. Wilson, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How goes it with this, I guess it's a yellow river out there now. I mean, the photographs are terrible.
Yeah, we've had better days. Our little river, took a major hit last week, so.
Are you losing business?
Yeah, business is come to a total standstill. They have closed the river since last Thursday, so we are just kind of playing the waiting game right now.
Give me a dollar amount. How much have you lost in what, 5 or 6 days?
Yeah, I was just looking at what we were bringing in last year, same week, and we're looking at about $30,000 and counting.
And how many people do you employ? I mean, that's got to be a huge hit.
Yeah, it's huge. We're one of the smaller companies, but we still have, you know, 7 full-time people that are kind of just standing around.
Are you still paying them, or have you laid them off, or what are you doing with your staff?
Well, right now we hadn't heard, a time frame until last night, so we're going to be shut down for another week. So
yeah,
we're going to go to Plan B. We're hopefully going to just keep paying them and get hopefully reimbursed on the back end from the EPA.
Yeah, what are you hearing from the EPA other than we're not going to talk about opening the river until the 17th?
They're just letting us know that. Of all the heavy metals in the river, and but at the same time, they're not really sure of how they're harmful to us and the environment.
Yeah. When you go down, how far are you from the river? Are you right on the banks, or are you a ways away?
Our location is right on the banks of the Animas River.
So stick your head out the window now for me and tell me what it smells and looks like.
Well, it's returned to, the nice aqua green color that it usually is, but the problem is the entire riverbed is covered in this bright orange sludge. So that right now is the main concern of, is that harmful to human contact? What's going to happen once the river comes back up? How are you going to clean that?
Yeah.
There's just a ton of unanswered questions that we're kind of waiting for the answers for.
Matt Wilson owns Four Corner Whitewater Rafting up in Durango, Colorado. Mr. Wilson, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up,
I had kind of hit a creative lull and I wasn't feeling very inspired.
So what do? You go try every pizza place in Manhattan. That's what you do. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 212 points, 1.2%. We got the sad mandolins today, I guess, 17,402. The NASDAQ gave back 65 points, about 1.25%, 5,036. The S&P 500 off 20 points, 0.9%. Ended things at 2,084. Automakers and big industrial concerns fell after China devalued its currency. Remember what I was saying up top? Global economy? General Motors shares off 3.4%. Ford off nearly 2%. Here's Caterpillar off 2.6% today. Commodities down as well. Crude oil for September delivery off more than 4%, down around $43 a barrel is where crude sits today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for June. The International Energy Agency is scheduled to release its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And in case you haven't wasted enough work time watching cat videos, the Internet Cat Video Festival is held in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Doing business in a setting where you know all the rules can be hard enough, but you get yourself overseas where the local customs are untaught and sometimes even unspoken, and that deal you are trying to get done can come to a screeching halt. Marketplace's Sally Herships is just back from a trip to Japan.
Recently, I went to a dinner meeting in Tokyo. In Japan, a lot of business happens over meals. I was meeting three Japanese professors. Two of them came in and sat down across from me. And that's when things got, well, Japanese.
Okay, so I noticed when we first came in that this seat was left empty. So I'm curious to know why you left this middle seat empty.
I'm the oldest.
Toshihiro Nakayama teaches policy management at Keio University. And like he said, he's the oldest.
Well, the center seat is supposed to be a seat for a... You know, I kind of hesitate to say that I'm the most important. I'm just the oldest guy. But in a Japanese culture, an oldest guy is supposed to be someone very important.
What this means is when you go to a meeting in Japan, you don't just grab an empty chair and sit anywhere. Typically, there's a formal seating arrangement. And sometimes, if you're Japanese, you're just expected to know where to sit. Then there are the business cards.
So the Americans will just, you know, give you a card like this in a single-handed way. And that's very rude.
So he's taking the card and just kind of like, almost like you're throwing it at someone.
And we cannot forget the right way to bow.
You have to have the right bow in a right occasion.
Okay, but if you're not Japanese, how do you navigate all of this? Because doing business in Japan goes way beyond bowing and business cards.
And it's not only about the etiquette.
Yuko Morimoto works with Japan Intercultural Consulting. The company helps foreign companies get work done in Japan. Morimoto says what's really important is understanding the different styles of communication different cultures have. Like, we Americans have a reputation for being direct, but the Japanese, not so much. For example, take saying no.
So they say something like, that's a good idea. Let us think about it.
Wait a second. Wait, but then if I'm American, then I'm thinking that's really literal. That's a good idea. They want to think about it. That's a huge misunderstanding.
Right. Yeah.
Morimoto says the word yes in Japan just doesn't mean the same thing. It could mean, hey, we just met, and I don't think it's polite for me to say no right away.
Or they say yes. So, and yes mean yes, I'm hearing you. And that doesn't necessarily mean yes, I like it.
So when does yes ever mean yes, like an American yes?
Yes, it does. It does.
Now, are you just saying yes like a Japanese yes, or is that an American yes?
What I said now is American yes. So what is difficult is that it's not no all the time. It can be yes, or it can be iffy yes, or it can be no yes.
Okay, a no yes. But Morimoto says it's not just language. To understand what's really being said, you need more information. Like, was another meeting scheduled or was a contract signed? And this next thing is huge. She says Japanese are more risk averse than Americans. and they want consensus, so they can take their time with decisions and making sure everyone is on board with them. But Americans, we are just in a rush.
What is the biggest mistake you think an American company could make in Japan?
I would say extend your stay. Don't try to rush and, you know, make things happen in 2 days or 3 days.
Morimoto says Americans need to slow down and the Japanese need to pick up the pace and to be more direct. But she says American companies shouldn't try to be Japanese and vice versa. The reason we do business with each other is because we want something different. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There are, it's been said, 8 million stories in the Naked City. New York, of course, being the city in question here. The story for us today is pizza, specifically the plain slice, one of them eaten at every pizza shop in Manhattan, starting at Grandpa's Brick Oven Pizza up at 211th Street, working your way all the way down to Battery Park. Somebody did that and then wrote about it. The book is called Slice Harvester, A Memoir in Pizza, written by Colin Atrophy. Hagendorf, Colin, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Must ask this first question right off the bat. Why? Why eat all this pizza in New York City?
Yo, seriously? It's just because...
Yo, yes, seriously.
It's just because no one had done it. It's honestly, that was it. I was joking around with a friend of mine. I was like, oh, blah, blah, blah. Like, what's the best slice of pizza in Manhattan? I bet someone already ate them all. We, like, looked on the internet. And we were like, maybe we're just bad at the internet. But it doesn't seem like anyone did this. And I was like, well, I think I should do that. I had kind of hit a creative lull, and I wasn't feeling very inspired. And it just seemed like maybe giving myself a kind of difficult task.
A quest, right?
Giving myself a quest. Right. Sure.
You're like Don Quixote of pizza.
Kind of.
So what does a perfect slice of pizza, not even perfect, what does a really good slice of pizza have to have for you? Because you're a guy who knows.
Right. So when you take that first bite, you're not going to notice any particular standout ingredient, right? There's not going to be any star of the show. You're going to bite into that pizza, and all you can experience is the collective efforts of every ingredient working in unison to create a worker utopia in your mouth. There's no bosses.
Well, I'd have gone with the crust. Isn't the crust the boss? Isn't the crust sort of the leader of the pack, the foreman, if you will, of the
pizza?
Not
in terms of flavors. Sure, it's got to sit on a good crust, but yeah. When I bite into that, I don't want to say, oh, that's a good crust right away. I just want to think, this is a good slice of pizza.
You have a mythic memory of the perfect pizza, right?
I do.
It's from your childhood when you were a kid.
I have a favorite slice that I ever ate in my life, and that was when I was 13 years old, and I was going. My dad took me into the city to buy me combat boots because he's a mensch, and so we went down to St. Mark's. We went
down
to Paul's.
Down in the East Village or someplace, right?
East Village, yeah, 8th Street, and we're walking across 3rd Avenue, and at the same time, we both kind of smell this smell, and we turn around and look at each other, and just turn and walk back to the side of the street we had come from without even saying anything. And we walk into this place, St. Mark's Pizza. It has since closed down. And the slices come out. I went to pick mine up, and I went to pick it up with both my hands. And my dad, he just like kind of smacked the pizza down back onto the plate out of my hands. I was holding it two-handed. And he was like, no, you can't eat it like that. People are going to think you're a tourist. And then he picked it. He showed me. He picked it up, and he folded it with one hand. He was like, you got to eat it with one hand. You're big enough now. Your hands are big enough. You can do this.
I need you to tell me about Pizza Suprema then and Joe Riggio.
So I ate at Suprema. I was with my friends Eliza and BBC, and the three of us went in. We got a slice. I have not yet, at this point in eating pizza, gotten a second slice.
Oh.
And at Pizza Suprema, me and Eliza and BBC finished our slice, and we all kind of looked at each other and were like, I think we need to get another one. And we went and got a second slice and sat and ate that one because it was so good we didn't want it to be over.
And there's the karmic moment of this whole book is that there's a connection between Joe Riggio, and Pizza Suprema and St. Mark's, right?
Yeah. So it turns out that Tony Dara, the guy that owns St. Mark's Pizza, which was my favorite slice growing up, he was across the street neighbors with Sal Riggio, Joe's dad. And Sal had actually taught him how to make pizza. And so in a blind taste test of 400-something slices, I chose the one that had the same recipe as my favorite slice in high school as my favorite slice.
Yeah, no, that was the best part of this book.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, no, it was great. It was great. Do you still go out and have a slice every now and then?
Oh, hell yeah. I eat pizza all the time. I love pizza.
It's a book called Slice Harvester, A Memoir in Pizza. It's a really good read. Colin Atchafee-Hagendorf is the guy who wrote it. Colin, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, maybe the greatest 404 page not found page in the history of ever. You know, those are the pages you get when whatever you're looking for isn't at the link that you clicked on. Mostly, they are, we should all say, and no, they're really boring, right? But the FT has outdone itself. Why wasn't this page found, it asks? And these are all quotes. Moral hazard. Showing you this page would only encourage you to want more pages. Efficient market hypothesis. If you'd paid enough for the page, it would have appeared. There is a bunch of them. We've got a link on our website. Check it out, marketplace.org. All righty, got to go. The Dow off 212 points today, 1.2%, which you know if you heard the sad mandolin music. The NASDAQ gave back 65 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 off 20 points. That is 0.9%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, the senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.